Hi, this is Mrs. Cheesy Pig from Tasmania, and you're listening to Geo Talk, the podcast for geocaches down under.
In this episode of Geo Talk, we chat with Zitherin from South Australia about puzzle caching. We find out who won ACT Cache of the Year, and we get an update on geocaching in New South Wales National Parks. All this and more on GeoTalk. Well, welcome to GeoTalk episode 26, and you probably realise that there's been a delay for a bit of a reason. If you've been following the forums, you'll know that my partner Renee had a beautiful baby boy at the end of February on the 28th, and he came in at 4 kilos, which is around about, I think, 8 pounds 13 in the old speak. And it's been a few weeks now, and Nay and I are still getting used to his little routine and all his different cries. Apparently there are different ones and we haven't decoded them all yet, but it's great to have him about. He's a beautiful boy, and hopefully one day soon we'll take him geocaching. In fact, those who are heading up to the Autumn in the Blues event up in May over at Wentworth Falls in the Blue Mountains, we might see if we can make an appearance there. So thank you very much to all the well wishes and congratulation messages that we received, and also to Eisenrai, who included a picture in his video podcast. It was quite funny to see the two of us there in that podcast. Of course, when you have a new baby in the family, you find that you go through what is a caching drought. And I've been looking at my logs, and I think it's been since the 23rd of February, which means it is just over a month since I've been geocaching. And I'm sure this is not a unfamiliar story to anyone who's got a new member in the family. And so I'd love to hear from you how long it took before you were able to go geocaching again after you had a baby in the family, and how long it took before you actually took your young child or baby or infant out geocaching. How old were they when they first found their first geocache? So drop us a call or an email. Remember, the number is 02-800-50-436. So that's 850-GEO, or an email to geotalk@mac.com. Love to hear from you. One thing that I thought might be important to remember, given that we're now moving into autumn, the cooler months of the year, is, and all that sort of hectic chasing around for caches during the summertime are over, it might be time to have a look at some of your own geocaches and do a bit of cache maintenance. And I know that there's at least two caches of mine that one of them has gone AWOL, which will need a bit of need replacing, and another one where the container is damaged. And there's actually a third one that I'd like to go check out because it hasn't been found for, I think, about 4 years now. So I might do a maintenance run in the next few months, hopefully sooner rather than later. But it's something that I think those of us who've got caches out there might consider using this time of the year to do a bit of autumn cleaning and check on our caches and see how they survive the summer months and make sure that they're all ready for the winter rains or cold or snow, depending on where you are in the country. Well, we got quite a long interview in this one coming up, so I'm not going to talk much longer. All I'm going to do next is just give you the GeoTalk trivia question for this particular episode, and it's on earth caching. Simple question: how many earth caches are there in Australia and New Zealand? And if you're clever enough, how many are in each state? The answer to that at the end of the podcast. Well, I'm joined by Nigel from South Australia, who also goes by the name of Zitherin, and you can hear the boos in the background from South Australia, who's well known for his puzzle caches, and we're going to talk a bit about puzzle caching. Welcome to the show, Nigel.
Thank you very much.
Now, first of all, let's get a bit of an insight into yourself. Usual question: how'd you come up with the name, and when did you start geocaching?
Name is an old character from a role-playing game from the 1980s. And it just used as one of those sort of online anonymous names on all sorts of weird forums and things. And geocaching came along as another weird forum, and the name stuck. And these days on Google, there's a lot more hits than makes my actual real name, which is a bit of a worry. So the pseudonym's sort of taken over. But November-ish, December-ish, 2003 was when I started.
And you started in Adelaide?
Yes, yeah. Spent all my time in Adelaide. I've got finds in other states as well, but the large bulk of them are in the Adelaide and country area.
What do you enjoy about geocaching?
The main thing is probably the chance of just getting outdoors. I do a bit of bushwalking as well, so it's nice to get out and about to places you might not have known about, places off the beaten track, that someone's own little area that isn't promoted or anything like that, and getting those sorts of areas is nice. The challenge of doing it, a lot of the time when I'm out caching, going between point A and point B, and so there's sort of a time constraint appears as well on a lot of my finds as well. So that adds to the challenge of in the middle of doing work or something, zipping out and grabbing something or on the way home. But getting to see places you don't normally see. So many places I've seen now, little parks and gardens and historic monuments and things that I'm pretty sure you'd never come across in 100 years of even living in a city and knowing it really well. I've lived here since the 60s and thought I knew the city pretty well, but the places I've found have just been astounding, really quite amazing.
How do your friends and family find it? I mean, have you introduced many of them into geocaching or many workmates?
There's a few people at work who are into geocaching, but they weren't introduced to it. Most friends wouldn't have the faintest idea I do geocaching. You can just tell if they're into that sort of thing or not. As in either friends from the pre-geocaching days. Family, I've got a couple of kids, so they enjoy getting out and about and seeing things as well, particularly if it's more challenging than physical and involves sort of the higher terrain sort of ratings. That tends to pique their interest a bit more.
And Adelaide seems to have a fairly active community. I mean, pretty much every capital city in Australia does these days, but Adelaide seems to have a high number of both caches and participants in the sport and a lot of events. I mean, do you get to many of the events and do you think that Adelaide is unique or are you just leading the pack?
I get to many of the large events, the regular sort of monthly events we seem to have now. I don't always get to those. They're in town and I work a fair way out of town. I'm not too sure why Adelaide has such a sort of seemingly large caching group. Our events these days, our Christmas event, eventually got too large. We were starting to have trouble finding places that weren't ridiculous to put it into, extent it was getting up to about 100 people, and that suddenly starts cutting out a real lot of restaurants. And getting close to Christmas time, it was potentially becoming a real issue. And every year, all the events have got bigger and bigger. The first one I went to, which would have been back in 2004, probably had about 40 people there or so. And these days our major events are up around getting close to the 100 mark, which is quite surprising compared to a lot of smaller clubs and things, more traditional sports and hobbies and things. Don't get anywhere near that amount of people. I've never worked out why. We've talked about it amongst ourselves, and possibly... there were a few very early adopters. There's Fredo and Astro and a few other teams like that who were in there from the very early days, like within the first year of caching starting. And that was probably getting a head start on it. They also put out quite a few caches, and they're quite good, and they're spread around, so that probably had a greater pull of people in. And the quality of the caches around Adelaide is pretty good. A lot of them are really quite clever, even traditional caches, quite clever hides in many caches.
Now, amongst those clever hides, there seems to be a lot of fairly challenging and sometimes difficult puzzle caches, and this is where I suppose your reputation comes into play. You're one of the big puzzle hiders in Adelaide. Tell us a bit about why you got into setting up puzzle caches.
In some way, it was a supply matching a demand to some extent. The first ones were sort of a bit of an experiment that done some puzzle caches. And I've always been interested in doing puzzles and things along those lines. And so the realisation that people are combining puzzle and caching seemed to be sort of a pretty natural sort of get together. So just looking through my logbook of the first caches that came out, one thing I have done is actually keep all of the caches in a nice folder, which makes life easy when people phone up and want to know about things. The first puzzle cache I actually did was actually my third cache called Thorndon's Dancing Bees. And many people have complained about this cache, that I must have been on something and it was designed. It's pretty esoteric and is a sort of a combination of you need to be there to get hints and then to decode a small story that talks about some pretty crazy bees. And then from that, it leads to the one little offset off to the cache. And people seem pretty happy with that sort of first effort. And there's a few more multis came up along there. And then a first attempt at a straightforward sort of puzzle when I was experimenting with some camo and things, and that seemed to get success. And then the third puzzle cache came out was a cache called White, which was the first of my infamous colour series. For those who are not from Adelaide, there's a series of caches based on the colours of the rainbow, and White was the first puzzle cache. It was a 4-star difficulty. People probably argue that 4-star is probably a bit on the light side. And that basically had two levels of hiding of information within what appeared to be a reasonably straightforward sort of image. And that had quite a good response from people as well. So that started the idea of maybe I'd have a series of those, which then led to a whole lot of this green and blue and red and ultraviolet are in that particular series. And then further along the line, there was I did a Cluedo cache, which even though it's not a puzzle cache, is in some ways it's a multi where you go along and collect the Cluedo cards and things. And it hasn't had a great deal of finders, probably due to the distance it's spread over. But that seemed to get a lot of nice comments coming back and sort of really enjoying the caches. So in some ways, the feedback from the finders drove the fact that I keep on putting out these caches. And some of the Japanese puzzles as they appeared from overseas, Kokoro, which was came out to Australia soon after the Sudoku craze sort of swept through. I've always sort of followed the Japanese puzzles and enjoyed doing those. So incorporated the Kokoro into a puzzle. And it sort of spread on from there. Then they started getting difficult and the terrain went up. And that's probably when the booing and the hissing started at the events. One of the first was a cache called The Slot, which is a 5-4 cache. And apart from the difficulty of the puzzle, which is hard to even try and work out exactly where to get started on it, the terrain has ended up being a little bit more spectacular than expected. It's a bit of virgin, very steep hillside, and it was about the second team dislodged what they thought was a small boulder that turned into a size of a small car's front end that decided to roll down the hill, taking out trees on the way. And I think that was sort of the reputation of that and some of my other traditionals in the terrain, sort of built upon the difficulty of the puzzles. And since then, the responses at events has been quite interesting to put it mildly.
You seem to wear this like a badge of honour.
Yes, I think you have to. It's not, you know, nastiness in people doing it. Like, yes, they are difficult and they're meant to be difficult, and there's a fair bit of care goes into getting the rating for these things correct. And I'll spend a fair bit of time looking around at other puzzles that are similar and try to make sure that, you know, if when people do a 5 or a 4-star difficulty cache, there's no, you know, illusions there that this is going to be an easy pushover sort of cache. And plus making sure the terrain matching is suitable so people don't, you know, think they've cracked a really great hard cache and find out it's even difficult when it comes to the terrain. So I think part of it is being consistent there as well. Yes, there's the really hard caches, but people know they're really hard. Generally, when a Zithron cache comes out, there's sort of a collective moan goes around, and there's a bit of analysis and tentative talk, and a fair few of them these days are being tackled by teams of people, which is pretty good because a few of them are sort of a bit of a penny drop to get started on the puzzle, and the train might be difficult as well. So a bit of a team effect. People seem to enjoy the camaraderie of solving some of these when it's done as a team effort rather than the sort of mental anguish of trying to solve some of these things by themselves.
Mm. As a hider, I mean, there's probably two points that come to mind. One is, I mean, as you pointed out, setting the terrain rating, and the other is giving help when people get stuck. On the first one, I mean, do you find that you need to adjust the difficulty rating, not so much the terrain, but the difficulty? I mean, have you had times when you found that a puzzle was more difficult than you thought it was, or less difficult?
Occasionally, I've put out a bit over 30 now, and I think there's two maybe I've had to adjust it by half or 1 point or one star. And that is one of the things that I think good cases do have the difficulty set correct. If you set the stars too hard and it's too easy, it can lead people to when they come to a real hard one and then getting really frustrated when, I've just nailed a 4-star and they go to a different 4-star and suddenly sort of, things aren't so pleasant anymore. And also having it the other way where the worst thing is where it appears to be easy and people just get too frustrated. And at the end of the day, you actually want people to find these things. And there's really no point in having a cache that is unfindable. That, to me, is a failure of a cache. I think the longest I've had an unfound puzzle cache is about a month, which I'd rate as if no one's getting it by a month, you're getting pretty close to the line of possibly too hard. The other thing is you've still got to maintain these things, and if geocaches are only finding them once a year, you're starting to run probably 50-50 with a muggle coming across them in some of the caches, so you're then doing a fair bit of maintenance potentially for not all that many finds, which is a great investment in time. And you do need enough people to be finding them just to basically give the taste and the teaser to other people that, this is solvable. And, it is doable. It's not some impossible sort of puzzle that can never be done. It isn't hard to design a puzzle that can't be solved.
Well, that was Zitheran talking a bit about puzzle caches. Now, in the next episode, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the hints that you might give to people who are looking for your own puzzle cache, and also some tips and hints on how to find other people's puzzle caches. So look forward to that in the next episode. Many of you will know that I started my geocaching days down in the Canberra region, the capital city of Australia, and each year they hold the ACT Cache of the Year Awards. Now, it's a great award, and it's been gaining quite a bit of momentum, and once again, it was hosted by the S's, who have done a great job in securing some prizes from some local sponsors. And the awards are a great way of highlighting some of the better caches that are placed in the region. And for new geocaches, it's a good way of them finding out which caches are innovative and creative and excite other geocaching participants. So with thanks to Bewilderbeast, who's down in the ACT as well, here is the announcement of the ACT Cache of the Year winners for 2007.
Thank you all for coming. It's been a great turnout. A very big thank you to the Bewilderbeast and Owen for Pigon for helping us. This year I don't think we would have got it done without them. It's been a bit of a bad month, and without them being event wouldn't have gone ahead. So thank you very much, guys. Now I'm starting to believe this thing's rigged. Usually I go category 4 to category 1, but this year, because we've got 4 prizes, so we've got a prize for the winner of each category, we'll go category 1 to category 4, and that way the winner of best cache gets to pick what they would like. The reason I think it's rigged, winner of cache of the year, again, Tank Engine, Paddy Rolling.
Yay!
Paddy Rolling. The Great Outdoor Centre of Phillips gave us some sleeping bags, and Jeff has donated some hire vouchers worth $50 for us, so
take your pick.
Runner-up coach of the year was M-Track with Canberra Night Odyssey. All right, winner of best location is Tank Engine with Zippity Zoo. All right, so runner-up of best location was Secret Squirrel and Captain Tomato with Jamming the Line.
Well done, guys.
Winner for most original. This one, all the other voting was very close, 1 or 2 points. This absolutely blitzed the voting. I think every single vote that we got in, this one was the one on everyone's list. And this was for Juju Extreme. Runner-up for most original was Sunbloke, DT Phone Home. We got the one that came in. Best photo, once again, this one was very close. I think it came down to 1 point. And so winner of best photo was Pink Engine with City of Flags. And runner-up was Wingland with Disembodied Tower.
Again.
Now, of course, GeoTalk isn't the only podcast that's about geocaching, and there are a few others, such as Podcacia, and you've heard from them a few episodes back. There's also the Cacia Maniacs, hosted by Daryl W4 and Firefly, and they recently had another local Australian geocacher profiled on their program, and it's Team Web Guy, who is a person that I go caching with quite often in the Sydney region. And here's a little bit of Team Web Guy on Cacia Maniacs.
Because of the kids, I like to do traditionals because it's quick and easy and they get to dive into the container and look at what they want to swap, so that keeps them happy. When I'm caching by myself or with my son, who's now heading on 15, we like to do more challenging ones, whether it's distance like bushwalking or abseiling ones. We have a few that require abseils and quite high abseils to get to, so I sort of keep the more challenging ones for when I'm going out, just him and myself. I've got a friend who basically, he's up for anything, so if I said, yes, we're going to do a 40-kilometre hike to find a cache, he'd be, yep, I'm up for that sort of thing. So
that's Team Web Guy and Cacia Maniacs, and if you want to get the full episode of that podcast and listen to their other podcast, they've spoken to a few other Australians and other people from around the world, go to caciamaniacs.com or you can find it on iTunes. Well, it's time to return back to a topic that I mentioned in the last episode, and that was geocaching in national parks. Now, there's been a bit of a development over the past 4 weeks since the last episode, and it first started with an email that I received from Frippy, and he asks or makes mention that a friend of his recently placed a cache in a national park, and one of the reviewers wouldn't publish the cache. Now, in the past, caches that have been placed in New South Wales national parks had been allowed to go through. Now, I've done a bit of reading through different forums and also been advised by a few colleagues that the Australian approvers, along with Groundspeak, will not be approving caches in national parks throughout New South Wales. So this is a fairly recent development, and it goes in line with the New South Wales Parks and Wildlife Service policy on geocaching, which is at the moment that they don't allow it. The developers at geocaching.com.au, the Australian website, are also setting up a system where they are mapping out the national parks and other areas across Australia, not just national parks, but areas where if you place a cache in one of those zones, as they're calling them, you will receive a message before you self-approve your cache, warning you whether there are any restrictions or requirements for that area. And you can find out a bit more about that by going into the Geocaching Australia website and doing a search on zones. It'll be interesting to see how things transpire over the next few months and years in this area. Now, some of you will also know that I'm behind a push to create an association of geocaches in New South Wales. And one of the aims, and I should outline or underline that it is not the only aim, but one of the aims is to educate and communicate and work with landowners in New South Wales about geocaching. And that includes the New South Wales Parks and Wildlife Service. Now, at the moment, I've got postings on both the Groundspeak forums and also on the Geocaching Australia forums about the association, which has been formed, and we're a group of people are in the process at the moment of sorting out some of the, I suppose, rules and aims and so forth of the association. And people will get updates, and there'll also be a website, which I'll mention in a future episode. But that's the situation with Geocaching National Parks at the moment. There are caches that still exist in there. Nothing has been done to them at this stage, and probably not likely to. But the word is that there will be no new caches in national parks in New South Wales through the Groundspeak geocaching.com website.
It's Matt from Big Matt and Shell. I just got back from the Illawarra event. Again, another great event organised by the Rats this year. We managed to make it our 900th find, so it was a bit of a milestone for us. We have another event tomorrow. Also, mate, congratulations on the new caching addition to your household. Hope everyone's well, and we'll catch up with you soon. See ya.
Well, that's just about it for this episode of Geo Talk. Just one email in the Geo Talk email mailbag for this particular episode. It's once again from Marcus Vitruvius, who you might recall in the last episode I mentioned that he was hoping to lead an assault on Mount Bogong, one of the tallest mountains in Victoria. He writes to say that five geocaches went along on the trip, and they also captured a bit of video footage on their camera. So hopefully we might actually see a bit of that, whether Marcus Vitruvius puts it up himself or sends it in, and we'll put it up for him. He said he really enjoyed the trip, and also was sending a congratulations on the new arrival. Thanks very much for that. And of course, before we finish up this episode of GeoTalk, the answer to the GeoTalk trivia question, how many earth caches are there in Australia and New Zealand? The answer for Australia is there are 32 earth caches. The state with the most is Victoria with 12, then New South Wales with 5, followed by South Australia and the ACT with 4, Tassie with 3, Queensland with 2, and WA and the Northern Territory with 1. We've actually been beaten by our friends over the ditch in the Tasman. New Zealand actually have 33 earth caches. They have 23 in the North Island and 10 in the South Island, and with pretty amazing geology. Well, that's all for this episode of GeoTalk. In the next episode, part two of our interview with Zitherin, finding out a bit more about puzzle caches, and hopefully we'll get a bit more of an update on geocaching in New South Wales National Parks. Until next time, safe geocaching.